This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week we'll find out how a local writer was inspired to create a fictional Cape Breton village through his collections of short stories, and a conversation about Nova Scotia's financial future, according to a Cape Breton liberal. Dave DeVoe from the Coast Newsroom catches up with Northside Westmount MLA Fred Tilley. That's up first on Dialogue.
Okay, so Fred, you've had some time to digest the budget after it was presented. Your reaction to it?
Well, we're actually quite disappointed in this budget. It's been dubbed as a more healthcare faster budget, but in actual fact, what it really does is it really grows our debt over the period of this mandate. So what's going to happen is that we're going to grow our net debt by $5.6 billion over the next 3 years. And that's a significant amount. So we're going to go from $16.6 billion in debt to $22 billion in debt, over 22. And why that's important is when we think about debt, is the servicing costs of those debts. So the fact that we're going to have interest rates are rising, that we're going to have to pay the service costs on that. And by the end of this mandate, we're going to be paying close to $1 billion a year just to pay the service costs on the debt. And that's a significant amount of money that can't go into other programs and services within the province.
Now, it's interesting you're making that argument, because I'm thinking about some of the federal conservative responses to the federal liberal budget, and they make very similar claims. You know, they say it's the federal liberal government that's involved in big spending, and it's the conservatives federally that are making the kind of argument you're making. And I guess the response some people make to it is that what you really have to do is look at debt to GDP ratio, not just the absolute amount of spending. How do you respond to that kind of argument?
Well, that's a great point. And if you look at the projections for the debt to GDP ratio for Nova Scotia, they're going to climb to close to where we were during NDP territory. So just a few short years ago, in 2013, we were at 38%. Under the previous Liberal government, it was brought down to around 32%, which is a lot healthier. And what we see happening with this current forecast is that debt to GDP ratio will grow back to around 37% by the end of this mandate.
So how do you think that compares to your federal Liberal cousins and their what the federal Conservatives would call big spending?
Well, you know, I mean, at the end of the day, someone mentioned to me the other day, the finance minister delivered his budget, and then they listened to me deliver my my response to that budget, and they thought we had our parties mixed up. he sounded more like the Liberal, and I sounded more like the Conservative.
But is there truth to that?
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, when it comes to spending, for me, spending has to have a purpose. And, you know, this current Progressive Conservative government is dumping 6.2, I think it is, or $6.4 billion into what they're calling their health care budget. And unfortunately, what we're seeing is all of the metrics. And last year, they spent $5 billion, I think, in healthcare. And we're seeing all the healthcare metrics get worse. So the wait for a doctor list has doubled. The emergency room closures have increased. The staffing shortages have increased. So all of those, the surgery wait times, they haven't met their benchmark to be at the national average within 18 months. So we're you know, the biggest thing we're worried about is the plan for spending this money. Spending money is great, but if it's going in the right location. So if you look at this budget, they are projecting over the next 3 years a $1.6 billion deficit, with the highest deficit of $610 million being spent in 2025, which is the last year of their mandate, which would be clearly be their election spending. But we're not seeing a plan. And the other piece that I'd like to bring up is around the fact of the additional appropriations. So there's a rule in the legislature where through an order in council, the government can actually spend money without consulting through the legislature. We're the only province left in Canada that does that. And the government will say, you know, we've heard the minister say, well, you know what, we didn't set that rule. That rule was set by the NDP. The Liberals followed that rule. And now we're just following the same rules everybody else did, which is true. However, they're taking it to an extreme. So this year alone, they spent $1.6 billion outside of the budget appropriation, so without legislature oversight. Included in that was half a billion in the month of March. And we saw that most recently with the $320 million for this year alone rebate to nurses or bonus to nurses and healthcare professionals to attract them to stay in the profession. So it's clear to us that if you remember back last year, there was a big budget surplus of $350 million. And it's because the government didn't realize that they were going to have this surplus. Well, they made sure this year that they weren't going to show a surplus. They made sure by throwing $500 million out the door in March, which was not well thought out. And we're seeing that now with this retention bonus. Healthcare workers, many of them are not included. So casuals who are working in the system, working full-time hours, supporting others, and they just can't get that full-time position, they're left out. Folks that were off on workplace injury but are coming back, they're left out. Folks that may have been on maternity leave, they were left out. And then the other interesting piece is that they qualified the value of healthcare workers by a number. So if you're one type of healthcare worker, you got 10,000. Another type of healthcare worker, you got 5,000. And we're hearing from all other types of occupations as well as what about us? We didn't receive that thank you from the province for working through COVID, for keeping us floating through this time of work shortages. So I think what we're seeing is a lot of spending without planning.
Let me just pick up on something here. On the one hand, you're objecting to the amount of spending. On the other hand, you're saying the spending doesn't cover enough people in the healthcare system. And if it did, that would actually require more spending. So I guess the question for you is, which is it? Is it not enough or too much?
Well, that is a great question, and I would say it's the right amount. So if you're going to put out a program, then you better be sure that you're putting out the right program at the right time with the right expense. So what I'm suggesting at this point is I'm talking about the program that the PCs put out on this retention bonus. They clearly didn't think it out because they spent $330 million and they left a lot of people out.
But should they have put out that retention in the first place? Whether suppose it was more comprehensive, should they have put it out in the first place, or should they have held back?
Well, I think they really need to look at their priorities, and they need to look at what it is by working with the nurses' union, by working with the healthcare unions, and this is done completely outside, and we've seen this from this government, completely outside the bargaining process. So if nurses, if healthcare professionals, if other groups had a living working wage, I think some of these retention bonuses might not be necessary. The other piece that we're hearing from nurses is a retention bonus. Well, that's great, but they're making lots of money in overtime, making lots of money in their shifts, but they can't get time off. So another big piece of this is working conditions. And we heard from the government that during the election that we're going to fix healthcare, we're going to fix all the problems. So right now, it just seems like they're grasping at straws by putting out these programs that aren't completely well thought out or aren't really socialized with the different groups.
Okay.
So I guess to answer your question, are they spending enough? In this particular case, with the retention bonus, I don't think they're spending enough. I think they should have looked at this more holistically and looked at the entire group and came up with a number that would benefit all of those workers. And they could have done that within the same envelope. But I think they just wanted to get it out the door. And they needed, the problem was they needed to get it out the door by the end of March.
Yeah, I mean, there's that consideration, but they might say, look, you know, both in terms of the haste with which the money was given out and in terms of the actual amount of the money, they would probably argue, look, we're in a healthcare crisis. It's not going to be solved overnight, but we've got to spend a lot of money. And in some cases, we got to do it really quickly. You know, is both the amount and pace of their spending not in proportion to the kind of crisis we're facing now?
Well, again, I think it goes back to why is there spending? So what it goes back to is what was the plan? So what is the actual things needed to improve healthcare? So we're not seeing what the plan is to fix healthcare. All we're seeing is we're trying this, we're trying that, we're trying this. So it doesn't seem like they had that plan that they promised Nova Scotians to fix healthcare. And what we're seeing is just blatant spending in different areas.
I think what they've said, is that there's not going to be one overall spending package that's going to fix it. It's going to have to be spent in, you know, umpteen different areas in order to make a whole pile of different changes, right? It's just not one or two funding packages that are going to solve it all.
Absolutely. No, I understand that. But at the same time, we haven't seen a plan from this government to tell us what those funding packages are. So how are they going to address the doctor waitlist shortage? How are they going to improve surgical wait times? How are they going to improve waits in emergency rooms? So we're not seeing the metrics tied to the spending, I guess is my point.
Okay, what about some of the measures that they've come out with, like patient advocates and other, what they would argue, I guess, are practical measures in the emergency room?
So, you know, and again, I don't want to diminish the work of healthcare professionals at all, because they're all working at stressful levels. But when you think about a patient advocate, so a patient advocate, and I haven't seen the job description of the patient advocate, but when you come into an ER and you're triaged, I think those funds would be better spent in more triage and in constant triage. So some of the things that we're seeing is that you get triaged, you know, I'm not sure you need an advocate when someone is writhing in pain in an ER and they're not able to get the attention that they need because of the you know, the short staff, because of the system that's in place. So, you know, I guess time will tell on how that improves. But I think, you know, again, working with the healthcare professionals and working with different unions, they should be able to determine what is required. And of course, it all boils down to people and getting the numbers of people within the system.
Okay. So before the Houston government got in power, there was a campaign where your leader at the time argued that we should be paying more attention to debt and criticizing Mr. Houston for saying that he was going to be going into deficit to fund, you know, to fix healthcare, as he said, okay? But some people might look back at that and say, well, the Liberals would not have spent a lot of money on healthcare, and things, even though the metrics have gotten worse with the current spending, under the Liberals, a critic might say, there would have been even less spending and the metrics would have got even worse.
So, again, I can't speak to a previous leader, but what I can tell you is that the reason that I decided to run for Premier Rankin at the time was that his commitment was to healthcare. So he was committing to make things better, and we were seeing things improving. Now, look, at the end of the day, healthcare is a big, big, big file, and it's a big issue. And I'm not suggesting it can be fixed overnight, But when we see it getting significantly worse, and when we see our deficits growing exponentially, and knowing that Nova Scotians pay the highest tax, income tax, in all of Atlantic Canada. And when we think about this budget, while the government will tell you that it's a healthcare budget, we're not seeing, again, like I said, the improvements, and we're not seeing the specific pieces in this budget that are going to improve those specific areas. But what's missing from this budget is help for Nova Scotians with what the other biggest issues that we're seeing in Nova Scotia is, the affordability situation. So we've put several bills, I put a couple myself in place, to cut gas taxes, to remove bracket creep. So in Nova Scotia, again, we pay the highest income taxes in Atlantic Canada, and the Fraser Institute just put out a report that we're like number two in all of North America in the taxes that we pay. And we're not seeing any relief from this government in that area. They simply say they're not going to do it. So
can they afford to do it when this healthcare issue is before them in the way it is right now?
So we've seen a significant increase in income taxes in their revenue year over year. And a lot of it is because of this growth in the tax brackets. Ourselves and Prince Edward Island are the only two provinces in Atlantic Canada, or in all of Canada, actually, that don't index tax brackets. So as an example, a person living in Atlantic Canada making $50,000 will pay about $1,000 more in tax in Nova Scotia than they will in New Brunswick. They'll pay about $700 more in tax than if they lived in Newfoundland. And they'll pay over $200 more in tax than they lived in PEI. And if you took that over a 30-year career, a 25-year career, you're talking tens of thousands of dollars in extra taxes, which could easily be fixed by indexing the income tax brackets to inflation. We're in a very significant time of inflation now. So any of these bonuses or any of these increases in payments that are being made right now by the government, putting people in additional tax brackets because the rates are so low, they're pulling all that back through income taxes. So your question is, can we afford to do that? I don't think we can afford not to do that. Nova Scotians are struggling right now. They're struggling at the pumps. They're struggling to put food on the table. They're struggling to buy medications. And this is one way that we can help by reducing the motor fuel tax. We had an $8 million surplus in motor fuel tax. By reducing the tax brackets to an acceptable level, so increasing those tax brackets by the rate of inflation.
I guess when I was talking about whether or not we could afford it, as Houston, Mr. Houston says, you know, we're not going to do much changes to taxes until healthcare is fixed. That's his mantra, right? And in terms of affordability, he might say we can't afford it. We can't afford to tinker around with taxes too much now when we've got a big job ahead of us on healthcare. That's the affordability objection I was making.
Yeah, so Mr. Houston can't afford not to. So right now, and I'm sure you're aware, in Cape Breton, there's a lot of people that are struggling. They're struggling daily. Our property taxes are the highest in Nova Scotia. Our provincial taxes are highest in Atlantic Canada. Another piece that Cape Bretoners should be aware of in this particular budget is that we're predicting an additional $344 million in equalization transfers. $344 million to over $2.8 billion in equalization transfers. So when you look at the Houston government during the election in 2021, he recognized that there's a problem in the way equalization is doled out across the province. He recognized it so much that he decided to double the equalization payment to municipalities that deserved it in Nova Scotia. So in CBRM, they got an extra $15 million. In addition to that, he promised to renegotiate the terms of equalization with each of the municipalities, but he's yet to do that. And we see an increase in equalization payments, which means that were, you know, equalization is basically to provide the same level of standards for the same level of taxes. So the fact that we're getting an extra $344 million in Nova Scotia means that we're falling further behind in the ability to deliver those services. So therefore, CBRM and other municipalities should be getting a greater share of that.
How would you have handled that in the budget in terms of the grant? I know there was, it's 15 originally, right? And then doubled, but that would you have kept the doubling of it, or what amount do you think would be appropriate given your fiscal concerns?
So when I look at over 20 years since this grant has been developed, so a lot has happened in 20 years. So equalization, I'm not going to pretend, is an easy file to talk about, because there are transfers back and forth from the municipality to the province. But an easy way. So, okay, doubling it, we know there's a problem. I think what has to happen is an actual sit down with some outside experts to sit down and say what is actually required to deliver like services in like parts of the province for like taxes. I'll give you one example within the system right now. Education. The municipalities across the province pay a portion of, I think at CBRM it's probably around $13 or $14 million every year to the province for education. Education is clearly a provincial responsibility. A quick way to improve equalization would say, okay, municipalities, we're going to take over the education file. You're not going to be required to pay that $13 million. $13 million on a $14 billion budget doesn't even register provincially, but it makes a huge difference in a municipality like CBRM.
Okay. So we've covered a lot of ground there, Fred, and I've sort of play devil's advocate with you, as I think any interviewer should, but I guess maybe give us just sort of a sketch of what, say, an alternative Liberal budget would have looked like, or
well,
what you think it should have looked like.
Yeah, so certainly, you know, we would have spent on unnecessary healthcare initiatives that we felt were required. But we would have looked at the affordability piece, the housing piece. So in Nova Scotia, there wasn't $1 in this budget earmarked for new housing units in Nova Scotia. There was 1,000 new rental supplements announced. Unfortunately, those are great if you can find places to rent, but there are no places to rent right now. So what I'm saying is that this budget is like a soundbite budget. It sounds great at the top, but there's no meat attached to it. So we would have looked at affordability, we would have looked at housing, and of course we would have looked at healthcare. You have to look at the most pressing issues within the province, and you have to balance those out. At the same time, we also have a fiscal responsibility to future generations. To not put them into significant debt for the next 40 or 50 years. Our children's children are going to be paying for this budget.
Do you think the government should run no deficits at all? Is that still the position of the party? Or given circumstances, do you think there are times when perhaps a more modest deficit would be justified?
Absolutely. I think there are times when deficit spending is needed. This could be one in times of high inflation, in times when we need to help people. But that spending needs to be it needs to be organized, it needs to be planned, and it needs to be set up to provide the biggest impact possible for Nova Scotians. It can't be done when we realize we're going to have a surplus. It can't be done just to get things out the door when we feel like it's necessary. It has to be planned, and it has to be, if you look at the Newfoundland budget, they put out a healthcare budget just recently. They put out, it's going to be a modest deficit, I think maybe 160 odd million, if I'm not mistaken. But yet they also vow to be a balanced budget next year. So I think these things are doable. A $14 billion budget is a big, big budget, and there's ability to work within that budget. Our revenue's increasing, our province is increasing in people. So there are ways to improve those revenue streams. And then I think what you need to look at is the longevity and the appropriate level of spending that goes with that.
Okay. On that note, is there anything else you'd like to add, Fred?
No, I really appreciate the conversation. It certainly kept me on my toes.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for your time, sir, and I look forward to speaking with you again.
Sounds great. Thanks so much.
This week on The Good Sentence, in the past few months, retired CBU Press editor Mike Hunter has published two collections of short stories set in the fictional village of The Landing on the west side of Cape Breton. Paul McDougall talks with him about his stories and where his inspiration and ideas come from.
So, Mike, you've been fairly busy since you retired from, the editor, publisher, man in charge of Cape Breton Press for many years. You're on the other side of the desk now. Why don't you just tell our Coast listeners what you've been up to the last couple of years, just in a more or less general sense.
Well, I retired 5-6 years ago, and since then, of course, I've been trying to settle into that life. I may have told you in the past that I started working on a novel, and as far as my own writing goes, and of course kept in touch with publishing and helping people, doing some freelance with this and that. And, more to the point of the current projects, I took up, I tried writing some short stories, on the advice of a good friend of mine. I think his name was Paul McDougall. Anyway, he talked about, entering writing contests. I was trying to work on this novel and trying to hone my ability to approach dialogue and that sort of thing. And then I created some characters to enter some contests, and the characters just kind of took over. So I've been chipping away at them for a number of years in between, mowing the lawn and shoveling the driveway.
Well, you've got two collections out. The first one, they're in the fall, No Place Like Home, which is set in The Landing. And then just recently, more short stories from The Landing. So why don't you tell our listeners where and what the Landing is, okay, and what it means to you, this semi-fictional place on Western Cape Breton.
Oh, well, it's very fictional, Paul. we can't really connect it to a single place, but there are echoes, if you will, of some of the stories and characters and history and geography and the weather of this part of the country at the west end of Bridor Lake. And I really, really started to get into the whole short story thing, and there's so many interesting snippets of history without getting into, an actual history as I've been accustomed to it, through long pieces and nonfiction, other people's nonfiction. And I just got so enthused by being able to time shift, place shift, by turning a little snippet of history or a little snippet of a local character and fictionalizing them, putting my own spin. The first book you mentioned, No Place Like Home, is the whole thing started as a single collection, but some of them. Most of them were quite humorous, and the others are a little more serious, and it didn't seem appropriate to blend those into a single piece, so they were divided into two. So No Place Home, like Home, is humor, or at least it's meant to be humor. Various stories taken snippets out of the places and the people and the history here up here in West Bay. And The Echo, along the same lines, but a little more serious, as I mentioned. It's been a lot of fun.
I'd have to say, from reading the books and the stories, that you have created an interesting place, The Landing. I could see someone, in another part of the country, maybe reading these stories and thinking, these days everyone has, one way or another, has heard of Cape Breton through literature or music or what have you, and then thinking, man, maybe we should drive up this coastline, see if we can find The Landing or this place like The Landing, whatever. You've done a really apt job of, making up a place. So why don't you give our listeners just a little feel for the, as you say, the entirely fictional community of The Landing. Maybe give us a little, a little drive down the main street of The Landing, because it isn't a big place.
No, it's actually, quite a small place, but there's a lot of action packed into the community. And it's on the shore of the Bredora Lake, as I think we mentioned. So there's lots of activity on the water and on land. There are mentions of wildlife, and the wildlife both in and out of doors, of course.
You go in one of your stories, No Place Like Home, you go into quite an explanation of how you actually get to The Landing with someone who's new to coming there. Do you remember that?
Yeah, in the title story, perhaps. Is that the one that you're referring to?
Yes.
Yeah. And, of course, the main character in that title story, the short name is Sibby, Sibella Sandusky. She's from the U.S., from Boston, and comes to Cape Breton partially in search of her Cape Breton roots, even though she's never been here. Her grandmother was from the Landing, and she promised her late mother that she indeed would visit and would look up this, a long-lost, possibly family member. So she comes completely blind and meets and engages with some of the local color, the local characters. It's done in a humorous vein, and deals with nicknames and that kind of thing. And I hope that it comes to a bit of a twist at the end. Something that we don't see very often in a Cape Breton story, particularly a CFA or a Come From Away Cape Breton story.
Yeah, it's a really nice story. I have to say the stories are really funny. So I'm just going to read this I'm just going to do this little passage here from this story for our listeners to get an idea. So Sibby, this one of the first characters she runs across is Sandy Ban McDonald, and she's asking him about places she's trying to get to. So she says, "Is that near Dundee?" she asked. "I plan to stay at the resort there." "No," says Sandy Ban. "Yes, Dundee is on West Bay, but not in West Bay." "On West Bay Road?" she pressed. Her tormentor shook his head. "No." "Dundee Road?" she tried hurriedly. "Yes." "No, Dundee is on West Bay Highway. You take Cenotaph Road here from West Bay Road to West Bay, turn right, then left. That's West Bay Highway," Sandy Ban finished for her. And it just goes on from there. But it's so true, all these, like, it's the road that's a place, and a place that's, named after a road. It's, and for someone not from around here, certainly can be confusing.
Oh, yeah, you can throw up your hands sometimes. Interestingly enough, the government recently changed the name of West Bay Highway. So, not based on this story or the confusion, I think. just the rescheduled snowplows, maybe.
Yes, and speaking of snowplows, one of your stories, A Wing and a Prayer, that first came to light a number of years ago. You submitted it to when Ed Ed Gillis is doing the Ed's Bookstore short story contest, and that was a winner in that. And it's the story of a plow driver and his nemesis. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that story?
Well, the snowplow driver has a musical bent, and he finds that he can kind of pound out a tune as he's driving the snowplow, the way the snow and the rocks and the gravel ping off the mailboxes and various buildings and trees and that sort of thing. So he likes to drive at a speed that suits the music that he's feeling at a particular time. His nemesis turns out to be a priest who's newly retired to the area and decides that the snowplow always drives too fast down his road. So he tries to, let's say, guilt the snowplow driver into slowing down. He builds a large snowman, dresses it up as a priest, and puts a sign that shall we say, encourages belief in slow driving, and there's interaction between them that a lot of people do find quite funny.
Yeah, it's really funny, and this is one of the stories where you get into some of the business of nicknames. So the snowplow driver is John Norman McDonald, and he's a big guy. So oftentimes around here, big people somehow get called tiny. You know, you get called them by the reverse. So you say in the book that, you know, that but that's not the name he got. His name is Tim, and as you write here, I'm just going to read this. So John Norman McDonald, or known as Tim, and not because of his size, you know, as in Tiny Tim, and not just because of the month of empty Tim Hortons cups on the dash. It's because Tim carries with him a donut seat cushion wherever he goes. Get it? Donut equals Tim Hortons equals Tim. And that's exactly the way some nicknames are derived around here. You've got to go through 3 and 4 iterations to, you know, like, figure out where that name actually came from, right?
That's right. And sometimes the nicknames carry on for generations, even though the origin has been lost. It's interesting.
Yeah, long lost.
So, yeah, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Poor Wooly and Wooly's Hallmark Christmas.
Boy, I tell you, Wooly is probably my favorite character, and in fact, there's a second story with he as the protagonist in the more serious book called The Echo. Anyway, Wooly is a nickname, so called because of his thick, dark, woolly hair, and Wooly is probably someone we might refer to as being somewhere on the autism spectrum. So he's quite an intense conversationalist, and in a way is modeled after quite a few people that I've known like that. Anyway, poor Wooly goes into the village every Tuesday, the village called The Landing, goes in every Tuesday for a few groceries and to get his mail, and is confronted by a movie set. There are movies being made in the village, and he is completely confused by the fact that there's snow on the ground. It's August, but there is this fake snow on the ground, and it's fairly lengthy, and it describes in detail some of the things that happened to him on the movie set, including being confronted. He goes back the next week. Turns out there's a different movie being shot, but he comes back the next week dressed up in an outfit of his grandfather's that he has stashed away in a trunk, and he's dressed as though it's 1909, because the movie is set in around that period, and the crew think he's part of the cast. So, you know, poor Wooly, as everyone knows him, is caught up in all this. They think he's an actor, and he's just trying to pick up his mail. So he interacts with a Hollywood character, and who is actually a real person, and someone he greatly admires from a TV sitcom back in the early 70s or late 60s.
Yeah, it's a really funny story, and you say it's a Hallmark Christmas movie they're making.
Yes.
But you mentioned in the story that, I'm curious about this, when they make these, they sometimes are filming different parts of maybe three or four movies all at once when they go to a setting. Is that true?
I don't know. But it's, you know, watching these for the last number of years, you know, you can't avoid the Hallmark Christmas movies. It always seemed that, you know, those buildings look very familiar. So I just kind of extended that to, and if you check, like I did some research, and they do multiple films in the same set. The same thing, you know, happens in Canada and even in Nova Scotia. Whether or not they happen at the same time is, you know, is purely fictional. but that's true. They will use a village over and over and for different seasons. And I'm sure that I've seen in these Christmas movies, I'm sure I've seen the same places and the same people, but, you know, one's Valentine's Day and the next one's Christmas.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's, just had some fun with that.
Yeah, no, it's really funny. There's another neat story that you played around with, a man of exceptionally keen discernment and a surprise visitor to the area is, you know, the scientist Nikola Tesla. Tell our listeners just a little bit about that story.
Well, the character, Kenny McIntosh, is a real person from local history. And I was told once that he had corresponded with
Einstein.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you. My short-term memory is with Albert Einstein. I researched that. I could never find any evidence that they actually corresponded, but I did find evidence that he had written to the president of Saint-Effects about Einstein's theory of relativity. Anyway, another story about this Kenny McIntosh, and he was a bit of a scientist, was that he was trying to get to the bottom of these mysterious lights or fireballs in the night sky. So I just kind of ran with that, and of course he couldn't engage with Einstein at the time. So I had him, and I couldn't prove that he actually did. So I went completely fictional and had him hook up with Nikola Tesla, who was going through a period of kind of disgrace. He was trying to perfect wireless electricity, and that's from his history. So I just kind of put the two together, and had some fun with Nikola Tesla coming to the landing. And on to Marble Mountain and ending up sticking around and doing some of his experiments there. But unfortunately, he got into some hooch that had been left behind in the place he rented at the marble mine. And
That was really funny, the scene where, they wonder where's Nikolai at, right? He's up in the still, you know, way back in the mountain, right, where there's still, as you said, some moonshine or hooch still there. It's a really funny collection. I really like it. And but as you said, the stories, and there's about a dozen or so in that book, and same with the second book, which do take on a different feel. And Let's just talk about, so the book is, the second book is called The Echo, More Stories from the Landing. And tell us the origin of the Echo, like, well, you know, where does the, because that goes back, and we'll talk a little bit about the influence of the Highland Scots and Gaelic and that, because a lot of that, this is infused throughout a lot of your stories, but a lot of it comes out in this story. This one is has a kind of a different tone to it, okay?
Yeah, the title of the book is upon us. There's a story in it called Machtala, the Echo, which, of course, was a Gaelic language newspaper published in Cape Breton in the late 19th century. The story started in response to a contest writing contest that I entered on the advice of a very good friend of mine, you know, Paul McDougall. I think you might know him. Anyway, and it failed to do that, but I just couldn't help but like the way it sent. It's kind of a ghost story, and the protagonist is takes up the bagpipes. He had them as a youngster. He grew up in Toronto, but his ancestors were from the Landing, and when he was due to retire, he retired back here and occupied an old family home, and he took up his old bagpipes that his father had kept, and tries to find or form a group to commiserate with, you know, as he learned the bagpipes. And he ends up getting interviewed for supposedly a job that somebody is looking for, a memorial. It's kind of a ghost story, I guess. Well, I don't guess. I know it is kind of a ghost story.
Yeah, we won't say who or what the ghost is, but it was a really nice story, and it kind of harkens back to Scotland and where people came from. Correct.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. And I think there's quite a bit more of that in this particular book. There's always, I have to say, I think all of these stories are infused with Highland history, certainly with Highlanders.
There's one great line in that book, in that story, and it's a gentleman, you say this is the classic pun or bagpipe joke, a gentleman knows how to play the bagpipes and doesn't. There's so many of those bagpipe jokes, and we all profess to say we love them, but there's always those. There's the other one, you know, not from your story, at least I didn't see it, but, you know, the difference between the bagpipes and onions, right? And you know that one?
No, I don't think
so. When you chop up the onion bagpipes, nobody cries, right? So
yeah.
There's all this, you know, bagpipe humor, but I mean, in many ways, there's no instrument like it, right?
Yeah. Well, that's why I like the thought, too, that comes out in that story, the fact that the pipes will simultaneously calm isolation, but also give you a feeling of isolation. And it's a difficult relationship to understand how they make you feel.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. That's exactly right. No, these are two lovely collections. The easiest way for our listeners to get them would be just to go directly to Amazon.ca, I would say, right?
Yes, but they are available both from the Cape Breton Curiosity Shop and from On Paper Books in downtown Sydney.
Okay, that's terrific. Are both copies there now?
Yes, both the copies are there now. Well, maybe they're sold out.
Maybe they're sold out. Let's hope so. Yeah. They can send more up, right? No, that's great. So anyone in the local area... Literally, Bookseller's Corner. They're right across the street from right down the street from each other, or across the street, I should say. So you can pick them up there. If anyone's from further afield, wants Mike Hunter's books, No Place Like Home, or The Echo, you can purchase them online as well. So Mike, why don't you leave us? We've had a long relationship, so I'm going to give you more than one good sentence to finish on. Which is traditional. I'm going to give you many good sentences. So, how about a little excerpt from one of your books?
Okay, Paul, and listen, thanks, and it was great chatting with you. I hope to see you in person again one of these days. Maybe get you up here to one of our literary events. And thanks for doing this.
Okay, great.
Anyway, the excerpt I've chosen is from the eponymous story in No Place Like Home. The protagonist is a young female by the name of Sibby Sandusky. She has been living in Boston. Her mother passed away, and she kind of made her mother and grandmother a promise that she would look up a long-lost relative from the grandmother's youth. She's middle-aged, of course, but believes that she has Cape Breton roots. And she is about to meet with a local genealogist at the Landing in a little coffee shop that's called Harmony Gifts. Harmony is actually the name of a pet pig that lives in the shop. So here goes. Back in the landing, the village was coming alive in the morning when Sibby pulled onto the grassy verge across from Harmony Gifts. On reaching the top step of the veranda, she was welcomed once more by the pig, Harmony, which today was sporting glittering nail polish. She lifted a front hoof in greeting, but Sibby imagined it was to show off her manicure. Martin va, squawked Hamish. Hamish is a parrot that acts as a doorbell in the store. Good morning, Sibby replied as she entered the store and walked toward the cafe at the rear. Here's the last we was talking about. Look here, Susie. We brought reinforcements. This here's Ollie, Olaf Balderston. We call him Bothersome. Balderston gave her a nod and a toothy smile in acknowledgement. The man's chiseled features would make Kirk Douglas blush, she thought. Though he was much younger than the other two men, he seemed at home in their midst. Sibby judged he was closer to her age. Ollie here has taken quite an interest in the local history since moving here, what, 3-4 years ago? I keep telling him he should write a book. Sharp as a tack, he is. Sandy Band snickered. So sharp, some call him Offal. Alpha, like the knife. John Duncan jumped in. Sometimes he's full of shit, and we call him awful. Balderson scratched his chin with his middle finger in a silent rebuke. Nice to meet you, Susie, he smiled. He turned his attention to the smartphone cradled in both his hands and scrolled the screen purposefully with his right thumb. Here it is. I told yous. It says right here that human flatulence, that's farts to you old farts, contributes to global warming. His icy blue eyes sparkled in amusement at sharing the news, and he gave John Duncan an exaggerated pat on the shoulder as if to encourage him. So put a cork in her, why? I got to outlive yous. John Duncan held out his left hand to take the phone and read the evidence for himself. He reached out blindly with his right hand to Sandy Ban, saying, give us your glasses a minute, will you? I can't read these little words. Sandy Ban took a pair of eyeglasses out of his shirt pocket and handed them over. Just try to remember where you got them, he said. John Duncan responded, my memory is just fine. It's you we're all worried about. Jeez, clean these once in a while, will you? They're a disgrace. Serves you right for not cleaning my teeth the last time you used them, Sandy Bed said. He was watching to gauge Sibby's reaction. You know how I hate ketchup. Ollie winked at her. Like an old married couple, aren't they? And as John Duncan looked over the evidence with Ollie's help, Sandy Ban pulled up a seat of the vacant chair next to him and motioned for Sibby to sit. Now, Sibby, he patted the seat of the chair, saying, this old fart here tells me you have a special picture he thinks I should take a look at.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sunday at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-284-NEWS. That's 902-284-6397. Or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcasts, available now online at coastalradio.ca.